So here we are at the end of our first full day on this retreat. And our task at this point in the process is to cultivate the wholesome factors of the mind that lead to liberation from dukkha. The primary obstacles in this process are called pancha nivarana, five hindrances. They're distortions, cognitive distortions, and energetic disruptions in the way the system operates. The hindrances are sense desire, aversion and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. I mentioned earlier, I regard them as energy dumps. I'll be talking more about that later on. There's a process that's described in the fourth foundation of mindfulness for addressing these conditions. If sensual desire is present in him, he knows there's sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in him, he knows there's no sensual desire in me. And he knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed sensual desire can be prevented. This terminology is repeated for all five hindrances, just changing the focal topic in each one. And then the sutta goes on. In this way, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas internally and externally. He abides contemplating the nature of arising, of passing away, of both arising and passing away in dhammas. Mindfulness that there are dhammas is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the five hindrances. And this is a quote from Anallio's book, Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. Now, I heartily recommend this book if you really want to dive deeply into the Dharma. This is a wonderful resource. And if you email me, peter@orlandoinsightmeditation.org, I will send you a PDF, a free PDF file of this particular sutta. It is not an easy read. But Anallio is a contemporary teacher and dedicated meditator. He actually lives at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Barry, Massachusetts. So I use him as a resource often. There are several of his books that I use as a resource. So the quote that I just read is really packed with insightful information. Now, in its original form, it seems kind of exotic or alien. I mean, after all, it's in Pali, a language that was created expressly to maintain the Theravadan doctrine. Now, was never really, it may have been a sub-dialect of Sanskrit at one time, but its function was to stay the way it was. It's one of the things about language. A language will change over time. Well, Pali doesn't change. A dedicated language. So what this recommends is a direct knowledge of each of the hindrances. What triggers them? What kind of causes and conditions are associated with the onset of the hindrance? Its characteristics. How it goes away, and what can be done to minimize the likelihood of it returning. It goes on to talk about being able to have direct knowledge, contemplating these characteristics internally, externally, both internally and externally. A lot of commentary about what in the world that means. My current understanding, internally is obvious, your subjective experience. Externally, in my view, is being able to recognize when someone else's behavior is afflicted by a particular sense desire. To notice the nature of its arising and its passing away. That's the anicca factor. Now, arising and passing away, it's important to understand that we tend to think about that as the beginning of sense desire, as a phenomena. And then when you go back to the breath, it's the end of the sense desire. And that's certainly useful. Also, this arising and passing away goes directly to the momentary characteristics of all subjective phenomena. One of the things that Buddhism did admirably millennia ago was develop an understanding of how the selfing process operates on a granular level. Contemporary neuroscience actually supports this, that there's a moment of kind of formation, sort of like the way a wave operates. A wave comes up, reaches its peak, and then falls away, and it comes up, reaches its peak, and falls away. Well, this is going on for all of us all the time, even as I speak. Multiple times a second, a particular self-state organization forms and then drops away and then reforms and drops away. And each time it forms, it has a very slightly different configuration. So part of our practice, and I'll be talking more about this later this week, is to train the mind to be alert enough, agile enough, accurate enough to actually notice this. This is one of what are called the progressions of insight. I just wanted to put that in out to you, that that's what he's talking about here. Mindfulness that there are dhammas established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. This is what we call choiceless awareness. There's no real subject-object dynamic emphasized there. It's just suchness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That talks about the liberation of the mind from distress and confusion. Okay, so how does this happen? How does this operate? It's a manifestation of coordination among a variety of wholesome mind conditioning factors called chittasikas. Those of you who have been in our meditation hall in my backyard, there's a big chart on the wall about the 52 chittasikas. word chittasika basically translates as those factors which are contained within the realm of the mind, so to speak. They participate in the selfing process and shaping the sense of self. So I have up on the board there something that I mentioned earlier today, adapi sati sampajanya. I'll be revisiting this. There's a variety of ways to understand this, to use, apply different terminology. But just to describe it again, adapi is diligence. It's a quality of alert, engaged interest. Now, that requires some practice. I talked about effortless effort today. Well, when effortless effort is operating, the mind is alert and engaged and actively investigating the changing nature of experience in an ongoing way. That's adapi. That's one. Adapi represents one aspect of that. Sati, I described again today, is mindfulness. Non-forgetfulness, presence of mind. You're aware of it. There's a term in contemporary psychology called metacognition. I mentioned earlier that I talked about samadhi, that there's a recording posted on the website, the Seven Awakening Factors Part 3. Well, Seven Awakening Factors Part 1 talks about sati, mindfulness. And investigation of mental phenomena and energy, the first three of the seven awakening factors. They're pretty much different perspectives on the same adapi sati sampajanya. Sampajanya is an interesting term. Well, let me finish with the metacognition. Metacognition is you can find that in Wikipedia, and that's in the quotation. I mean, in the posting that I mentioned earlier. Metacognition is thinking about thinking, and there's a big article in Wikipedia about it in all of its different manifestations. Interestingly and ironically, talks about its early manifestations in pre-Socratic Greek philosophy, which is true. But there's evidence that pre-Socratic Greek philosophy was significantly influenced by Buddhist psychology. So there's no mention in the Wikipedia article about the Buddhist analysis, Buddhist sati, mindfulness, none whatsoever. Very interesting. I was tempted to contact them and correct them, but then I realized I just don't want to be bothered. Sampajanya basically has what are called the four clear comprehensions. And I've described them in a particular order, but they're sort of integrated in their functioning without any particular necessary order. To be able to notice the characteristics of a particular phenomena, to set a worthy goal for that, in terms of that function. So the first one is a worthy goal. Second one is, what is a suitable means for realizing that goal? Third one is monitoring that process to keep it on track. And the fourth one is making sure that it is in alignment with liberation from distress and confusion. So that's really what we're talking about, is right effort in that sense. But it's part of the first foundation of mindfulness, is sampajanya. And adapi sati sampajanya is mentioned over and over again in the Satipatthana Sutta. So that applies to the the nature of the hindrances as energy dumps. A couple of other terms that I want to bring to bear with this. One of them is Vedana. Vedana is feeling. Now, we tend to regard feeling as an emotion, and there's some validity to that. But the more accurate contemporary term for Vedana is affect, A-F-F-E-C-T. And you see that's up there on the first two, sense, desire, and aversion, the oh well. Affect is a characteristic of impulsive reactivity. So the whole notion of Vedana takes up, is the second foundation of mindfulness. Mindfulness of feelings. Vedana Upasana. So that's a very important part of cultivating the mind toward liberation from dukkha, is realizing how much affect has to do with self-organization. Doesn't mean that feeling is supposed to be eliminated, not at all. It's to be understood and worked with more skillfully. But you can tell that feeling is part of the first two hindrances specifically, but it's involved in the others as well, because feeling is something that's present in every moment of self-experience. Every single moment. It's a universal chittasika. So, when I'm talking about the hindrances, and I'm talking about them as energy dumps, I mentioned this earlier today, and I tend to repeat some of these things because I think we learn from, you know, touching these different concepts from different perspectives. And as your practice matures during the retreat, it might click into place. Oh, he talked about this the other day. And you actually have direct experience of it. So we are energy transforming organisms. What separates us from other energy transforming organisms is that a significant amount of the energy that we bring in through food and air is transformed into the mind, function of the brain, awareness. When the energy is flowing appropriately, channeled appropriately, it is, you know, used to its maximum benefit. Back to the laser simile again. There's very little loss of energy. Now, that manifests in terms of the awakening factors, which I'll be talking about later on this week, the seven awakening factors, just to bring them into the mix. Mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, energy / effort / energy / right effort / persistence, joy or enthusiastic engagement, tranquility, concentration / unification, I talked about that earlier today, and equanimity / balance. Those are the seven awakening factors. When the hindrances are set aside, those factors are freed up. Their potential for maximum benefit is liberated. It's activated, right? But when the hindrances are there, they're energy dumps. I'll be using similes that are classic similes regarding each of the hindrances. One of them is related to freedom of the mind. The other simile is related to pond, body of water. The first one is sense desire. Tamasava in Pali. And it's a kind of a preoccupation or an enchantment with a flow of mental phenomena that are pleasant. Now, the flow of pleasant feelings is not a hindrance. It's attachment to, enchantment by, craving and clinging in regards to the pleasant feeling that is the hindrance. It's an important distinction to make in your mind when you're aware of it. If there's a pleasant feeling and it flows, let it flow. But when your mind becomes really enchanted by it, wants to find it again and make it better and stronger and more durable, that's a hindrance. And so the whole notion of affect is related to affect approach, which is what's on the board. And that's a contemporary scientific term that basically means that when someone is exposed to some kind of stimuli, either a physical stimuli or a cognitive stimuli, and there's an orientation, there's an activation of the neurons in the brain that kind of aggregate around that pleasant affect, it's called affect approach. So, the Buddha regarded sense desire as being very difficult to deal with. Because who doesn't want to have a good time, right? Who doesn't want to feel good? Who doesn't want that extra piece of candy? The problem with sense desire is the consequence of it. The immediate consequence is that the mind is enchanted. The simile that is used is enchantment is, let me see here, where is it? Being indebted. You're bought by that. The other simile, the pond simile, is that you put, you know, the idea with it, when the mind is clear, when there are no hindrances, you can see into the depths of the water and discern what's down there. A variety of circumstances hinder one's ability to peer into the depth of the pond. The one with sense desire is a colorful dye. You know, you're enchanted by that color. You can't really see what's inside. So it hinders investigation. The mind is enchanted. So this gives me a chance to talk about two factors that are important to understand as well. Tanha and Upadana. Tanha is literally translated as thirst, but it's craving. There's a part of the brain that gets activated, in this context with sense desire, that gets activated that starts to want more. There's been a lot of research done on this in terms of addiction. Part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens that gets hyperactivated, kind of stuck in the on position when there's some kind of addictive process going on. Could be a substance addiction, could be what's called a process addiction, cruising the internet, reading a real page-turner book, you know, spending money. But that particular part of the brain just does not know when to say enough. We're all familiar with this. Some of us have been significantly impacted by sense desire, by tanha, thirst. It's an unquenchable thirst. Upadana is translated as fuel or sustenance. So that's related to the term clinging. Clinging basically is a kind of preoccupation or fixation of the mind. I use the term enchantment. Your cognitive processes become predominantly organized around some kind of justification for sense desire and disregard for the consequences of acting on sense desire. So that's the characteristic of it. What triggers sense desire? A couple of things. One of them is pleasant stimulation. The other one is a mind that is not prepared, that doesn't have enough samadhi paucity, enough stability of attention and tranquility of mind. Samadhi paucity, those are two of the awakening factors again. When the mind is unified around other wholesome conditioners and there's a calm non-reactivity, then we're less vulnerable to the craving and clinging of any sort, but in this case, involved with affect approach, sense desire. Sense desire can be physical or it can be psychological, being praised. That's a way to encourage craving and clinging, sense desire. Now, one of the things that I mentioned earlier, well, first let me think about what the consequences again. There are immediate consequences. You eat something that's too rich in carbohydrates, afterwards you have heartburn. Long-term consequences. You engage in some kind of convenience activity indulgently, and down the road there's a problem. An example that I use in the notes here, multiple examples, is craving for sugar. Well, the Everglades has been pretty much devastated by big sugar farms down there. And a lot of our state politics is organized around protecting those farms, even though they're polluting the Everglades. So that's a long-term consequence of sense desire. So what we want to do with this practice, the aiming and sustaining, the noticing and letting go back to the breath, is activate parts of the brain that actually manage the nucleus accumbens, a part of the brain called the preorbital cortex up here in the forehead that sends a signal down to the nucleus accumbens that says, enough already. Right? Now, that's not a self, it's just a function of neural networks, which are extraordinarily complex, that is involved in self-regulation. Affect regulation, let's put it that way, affect regulation. So with this process of Adipi Sati Sampajanya, you're able to notice the impulsive reactivity, the affect approach experience, with clarity and a characteristic of non-reactivity. Cultivating samadhi paucity acts like a buffer against impulsive reactivity. It's sort of like this sense desire wants to leap on stage and be in the spotlight. You notice that it's there. You notice it's ready to pounce, but just not interested. Not interested. So that's something perhaps you'll notice as the retreat goes forward, that there'll be times when something comes up. It could be any of the hindrances but you'll notice it in its early formative stage, and you'll realize, I don't have to go there. I don't need to do this. I don't need to think this. That's a really rewarding accomplishment, just in terms of having a better life. There's great implications for the process of awakening, but just in terms of self-discipline, it's a wonderful skill, craft of being a successful human being. Okay. I mentioned earlier, you know, these are very challenging times. Now and for probably the next 50 or 100 years, there's going to be more cultural and environmental transformation than any other time in previous human history. We really don't know where it's going to go. And we're technologically capable of this, but psychologically too immature to manage it. And that's why there's such a crisis right now. Politically, environmentally, economically, in terms of healthcare, you know, people don't really take good care of themselves in terms of health because of sense desire and to some extent the other hindrances. And it costs more and more to intervene. But when someone has the kind of self-discipline, self-awareness to get exercise, sleep a decent amount, eat the wholesome foods in moderate quantities, then your health is improved, you know, physically and mentally. So cultivating the ability to set aside the hindrances is a life-affirming discipline, not just in terms of your own well-being, but, you know, whatever implications your behavior may have in terms of the environment and interpersonal relationships and so forth. That's why I said at the beginning, you know, this, you're giving yourself and everyone you know a gift by dedicating a week of your life to this sort of discipline and hopefully continuing to do this. Okay. When you're aware of the sense desire, notice how it changes. If you really, you know, when you practice noticing the changes in the breath sensations, you're activating the part of the brain that functions to notice novelty. The two parts of the brain, the amygdala and the hippocampus. I'm oversimplifying things here. But their function is to assess incoming data, friend or foe, food or poison. The more you train the mind to be diligent and investigative of what's forming about something as straightforward as the sensation of breathing, those same neural pathways are strengthened when more significant affective drives are stimulated. There is little or no affective drive associated with the sensation of breathing. So you have to consciously decide to pay attention to the sensation of breathing. When sense desire comes up, your subconscious will leap on it, because we're hardwired for that organically. But the more you train the mind to override that impulsive reactivity, the better off you'll be. Next hindrance, aversion, ill will, vyapada. It's a preoccupation. It's associated with affect avoidance. Aversion is a withdrawing from the experience psychologically. The mind becomes more rigid, less engaged. Ill will is when aggression and hostility accompanies them. There's a lashing out, or a lashing in, if it's in your own subjective experience. It can be directed toward another person, or it can be directed toward your own self-image, kind of self-loathing. It's important to notice its characteristics in terms of that quote that I read out earlier, to be aware of its arising. What triggers it? It could be something you see out of the corner of your eye. It could be a sound. It could be a twinge in your body. It could be a memory, right? But to be able to notice it, adapi sati sampajanya, to notice it sooner rather than later, and acknowledge the distress and confusion that's associated with it. You know, with sense desire, the distress is wanting. People don't realize that wanting something is distressful. Pay attention to that the next time you want something. It doesn't feel good until you actually get what you want. Then you get it, you might lose it, right? Somebody might take it from you. You might, you know, misplace it, or it may not turn out the way you anticipated it to turn out. There's dukkha there. The dukkha is more noticeable with aversion and ill will. The distress is really evident. The confusion is there because the mind reacts to either not getting what you want or getting what you don't want. And it's really interesting to notice how quickly sense desire can flip into aversion and ill will. Those of us in committed relationships can probably relate to this, right? I love my wife. Everybody knows I love my wife, and she and I have a really good relationship. But there are times when she just does not understand what's important, right? So my sense desire attachment flips to aversion, ill will attachment. But I'm mindful of it. I see it for what it is. And, you know, it's, I don't have to go there. Those of you who know me know that the area where aversion, ill will is most likely to occur is my own self-image. I can go into a really awful self-loathing process. Not so much anymore. Kind of alluded to that earlier when I said that I neglected to print the bell ringing sheet. And then when it got printed, they don't have two colors in that printer. So, I mean, all kinds of stuff spun off from it. But I just noticed it. But there was a time when I would be really upset with myself. I'm not allowed to have imperfections. I'm sure that none of you all can relate to that. That's my own unique problem. So aversion and ill will has this characteristic of the energy of it is destructive. Destructive of well-being, destructive of confidence, destructive of relationships, and perhaps destructive of the environment. Now, I mentioned before, you know, our culture spends millions of dollars in very carefully cultivating advertisements to get you to buy something. Sense desire. Very, very sophisticated stuff. You know, same thing is true with aversion and ill will. You know, news reports, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, let's be scared. I forget who the author was. Maybe somebody can help me and remember it. But there's a current author who wrote a book describing the world is in much better shape now than it ever has been before in terms of humanity's well-being. There are fewer people who are starving, even after the pandemic. Fewer people who are getting ill and dying. Now, who knows what's going to happen with future pandemics and future of the environment, but we are conditioned to be fearful of the future of one another. Fear has its usefulness, but it's important to be very mindful of how to relate to what the perceived threat might be and deal with it skillfully. So the acknowledged antidote for aversion to ill will is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. The simile, aversion and ill will is like having a fever. And it's comparing it to a pond that is boiling. It's so hot. It's a pretty understandable simile. The next hindrance is sloth and torpor, tinamida. Sloth is, you know, the mind is slow. Think about a sloth. They move very, very slowly. Torpor, the mind is dull, drowsy, sleepy. Sloth and torpor. Now, that represents an overactive parasympathetic nervous system. I have it up there on the board. Now, there two systems are operating in the body, sympathetic and the parasympathetic. They're supposed to be cooperating, coordinated, so that there's some variability in them, but they're organized in such a way when it's done right that there's a quality of stability and tranquility in the mind, but there's also energy in the mind. So the parasympathetic system represents the tranquilizing function, and the sympathetic system represents the activating function. But with sloth and torpor, the parasympathetic is overactive. And so the experience is the mind is unresponsive, drifting and dreaming. I mentioned Chula Dasa. He describes it as subtle dullness. And this is actually kind of the default mode for us. Provided that you apply Adipisati Sampajanya for the next couple of days, there'll come a time in the middle of the retreat when you'll suddenly realize that you're much more alert and yet much more calm and physically relaxed. That's an interesting transformation, but you've got to train for the effect. But before then, it might be that you're going to find yourself nodding out multiple times. Or you're trying to pay attention, but your mind just will not respond. That's the subtle dullness part. So be of good faith, my friends. Trust me when I say this. Now, some of you have been on retreats, and you know what I'm talking about. Comes a time in the retreat when you suddenly realize that colors are more vivid, sounds are more vivid, your mind is more responsive and yet peaceful and relatively uncluttered. Right? But until then, you're kind of slugging through things. there's also a kind of resistance to actually doing the meditation. It's part of subtle dullness. You show up late for the meditation period, or when you go do the walking meditation, you spend the time daydreaming and wandering around the property. Perhaps you've noticed this. So it's something that you have to work toward resolving, but it's worth the effort. And what's the work? What I've been saying all along, aiming and sustaining, noticing when your mind wanders, bringing it back to the breath. The antidote for dullness is investigation. But dullness seems to prevail, so it's hard to investigate. That's the challenge. So it's important to be diligent, to make the extra effort to soak your attention into the sensation of breathing. Really look at it. Now, in the guided meditation tomorrow after breakfast, that's what the topic will be, is kind of going into a more investigative mode with mindfulness of breathing, which will hopefully wake your mind up a little bit more and cultivate more clarity. Now, once again, I want to say that it's not that we're, that the parasympathetic is to be gotten rid of. It has a very important function. Paucity requires an active parasympathetic system. But it's brought into balance with the other factors, the other awakening factors. And let me just kind of say this again. You first apply these skills to cut the weeds off at ground level, the hindrances of the weeds. That creates the potential to actually become more aware of the awakening factors. And I'll be describing them. There's another, in the same fourth foundation of mindfulness, there's a descriptive part that talks about noticing what, you know, prompts the awakening factor and what you can do to bring it to its maximum potential. You know? So it doesn't explicitly say in the sutta that it doesn't say that explicitly in the sutta, but there are strategies for doing that that we'll be talking about. The simile for sloth and torpor: mind is imprisoned. The other is the pond is filled with algae. Next one, hindrances, restlessness and worry. Udacha kukucha in Pali. And it's the overactive sympathetic system. Too much adrenaline. Restlessness is something that's pretty normal as well, which seems odd. How could the mind be dull and restless at the same time? Look closer. Your mind will be non-responsive, but jumping from one thing to another. Daydreaming. That's what one of the characteristics of daydreaming, isn't it? There's a quality of absence of discipline. Restlessness interferes with samadhi. Now, there are more and more sophisticated, subtle layers of restlessness that are addressed in the final stages of awakening. But what we're talking about now is, you know, basically the wandering mind. So, it's also possible to notice how quickly the mind will slip from dullness to worry. Right? I mentioned this maybe yesterday, maybe earlier today. The mind wants to chew on different issues. This is one of the things you'll understand with this practice. You'll realize this is how the self operates. The self needs something, in this case, to worry about. If I'm not worried, I'm not real. If I'm not planning something, what good am I? If I'm not angry about something, I'm a wimp. If I don't want something, I'm lazy. Right? Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't take care of business. I'm just saying that it's important to recognize how to find balance in our activities. So we can still get things done. I mean, like I said, the Buddha, for 45 years after his awakening, created a community that's lasted for thousands of years. That's pretty remarkable. No sloth and torpor there. No restlessness and worry. That's one of the characteristics of someone who's awakened. You get the job done without the distress and confusion. So, when we talk about restlessness and worry, the simile is like being held captive, and the pond is disturbed by waves and turbulence. And the antidote for restlessness and worry is tranquility, and also a clear conscience. It's called right livelihood. You know, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Traditionally, it's called restlessness and remorse. There's such an ethical core to the Buddhist doctrine that the word worry is not really emphasized. What's emphasized is the absence of ethical behavior. Remorse. I should have done this, I could have done that. Which, you know, could be an aspect of worrying. But our worries are more associated with, did I pay my electric bill on time? Or what's the traffic like? Traffic going to be like on the way home? Or why didn't I say such and such in that discussion? Right? All those kinds of things take up bandwidth in the brain. Well, the antidote for restlessness and worry is samadhipassati, particularly the tranquility part. So when you when this is all working well, if you can imagine a dynamic, I've got my arms up and crossed here, at the top of the vertical line is restlessness, at the bottom is sloth and torpor. On the left is, let's see what I have down here, sense, desire, aversion, ill will. On the right is skeptical doubt, on the horizontal part of it. So when we bring the Adipi Sati Sampajanya into play, there's a dynamic balance. Sometimes it's important to be a bit more, for there to be more energy, more sympathetic activity, and less parasympathetic. Sometimes it's important to be more skeptical, while other times it's important to be more confident. But you, with these skills that we're developing, you can monitor that and appropriately manage it. The last of the hindrances is skeptical doubt, visikicca. It has the characteristic of conflict, confusion, and resistance in the mind. The simile is like being in a desert and at a crossroads and not knowing what to do. Of course, the irony there is if you stand there analysis paralysis, that's where you are. You say, oh, I can't go to the left, I can't go to the right, I can't go back. All right, then you're staying where you are. There's been a decision made, but the quality of attention is inadequate or distorted. So skeptical doubt, basically, the quality of conflict, confusion, and resistance to commitment. There's doubt when you're doing this meditation practice. There's doubt about whether you're doing it right. There's doubt about whether what I'm telling you is valid. There's doubt about whether the system actually will produce the desired results. And you can get lost in that. My very first retreat pretty much wiped out the doubt. There was still sloth and torpor to deal with. I didn't meditate on a regular basis for years afterwards. I would just get all prepped up for a retreat and go on a retreat and then kind of slack off again. But now I meditate on a regular basis. There's no doubt in my mind. It's not perfect, and that's okay. You know, part of the skeptical doubt is it has to be perfect. If it's not perfect, I've failed. Or if it's not perfect, then it must be wrong. No, this is a training. This is a skill. And, you know, I spent a good bit of my life developing skills, a variety of athletic skills, artistic skills, skills in articulation, teaching, carpentry, so forth and so on. So I understand that you try it when it's wrong, you make corrections, and you try again, but you know that it's worth the effort. That's an important part. The antidote for skeptical doubt is to, first of all, consult with someone who's knowledgeable. And secondly, to be diligent in applying what's recommended. And I assure you that you'll have your doubts, but you practice as recommended. As imperfect as your practice is, you're likely to have an aha moment later on this week in which you realize, oh yeah, this is what he was talking about, or this is what I've read about or heard about. This is true. And I could describe any number of incidents over the 40 plus years of my meditation practice where these insights occur. Oh, I read about this. That's interesting. This, now I understand. I call them the aha moments. So I want to hold that out to you as a consideration for building your commitment to this practice. Okay. I think that's all I want to say about overcoming the hindrances now. We have the opportunity for you to ask questions about what you've heard me say today during the retreat, about your practice experience. I want to keep it on task. I don't want to get too abstract and philosophical, but I do think it's important to have some clarity about the concepts as well as diligent practice. So, also, I will say that in recording this, when you ask your question or make your comment, please speak loudly so that it's noticeable on the recording. So, questions or comments? John?
It seems to be a giant process of stress management. It's how you get out of control and how you get back, and how you can walk through it, perhaps dance through it, and maintain the balance is probably the healthiest way to go. And that's kind of what I'm getting from it, because you can, you know, load yourself up and lopside any conversation, any thought. And if you have a way to not think in words, go back to breath, you have a way to kind of balance as you go, and it's quite a powerful tool.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Can you elaborate on effortless effort a little bit? How does that work? It develops in through the practice spontaneously. I guess it would just discover one day that it's happening.
Yeah, it's not spontaneous. It's a developed insight.
What does it mean?
Well, I first heard it from Joseph Goldstein. He said that, you know, cultivating mindfulness requires a kind of ongoing, persistent effort. You know, you just keep getting distracted over and over and over and over again. You keep coming back to the basic practice over and over and over and over again. After a while, the process becomes more accessible and more workable. Contemporary psychology, there's a phenomenon is called state-dependent learning. There's other terminology that doesn't come to mind right now, but basically what it means, it's long-term potentiation, that's it. Whenever we have any kind of cognitive event, neural pathways are firing off. There are a certain number of connections between the neurons. The more you send energy into that system, the stronger the signal strength is, and the more neural connections there are between those neurons and between associated neurons, so it kind of spreads out, right? So when you make the effort to enact a particular procedure, aim your attention at the beginning of the in-breath and sustain it for the duration of the in-breath, those neural pathways are enacted. Energy goes there. And in a sense, the nerve process has become bulkier, stronger, and more deeply interconnected. So in the future, the more easily stimulated and more effective in generating a signal strength. You see how that could be?
Yeah, for sure.
Systematically?
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's really interesting about how the connection between neuroscience, contemporary neuroscience, and Buddhism. Been a lot of research about that. So that's how it becomes an effortless effort. The energy is there, but it doesn't take as much effort to enact it. Of course, now, the same thing is true about a nasty habit. Same thing is true. Neural activity is ethically malleable. You know, you send energy there, it's going to get stronger, it's going to be more easily accessed. So losing your temper becomes easier and more potent. Or self-indulgence becomes easier and more potent. So overcoming that requires some diligent effort. So we're countering the hindrances. But there's already energy bound up, the energy dump part of the hindrances. There's already strength and energy in sense desire, self-indulgence, right? We've been doing it for decades, and we're deeply conditioned to do it. We're rewarded for doing it. So the effort to overcome it is challenging, but it does work. I forget who it was who said that it's something called neuroplasticity is what I'm talking about here. Neuroplasticity will save the world, particularly when it's related to something like mindfulness or metacognition. I mentioned that article on Wikipedia about metacognition. They talk about how valuable that is socially and culturally. Okay?
Great, thank you.
Yep. Grace?
Would you liken it to like playing an instrument? Like it takes conscious effort. I think of like playing the piano. Mm-hmm. Like you learn one hand first and that takes effort, and then you learn the other hand and then you can put them together. Mm-hmm. And so there was effort in that, but then once you get like the muscle memory, you can just kind of play like that?
It's exactly that. That's long-term potentiation. It's also state-dependent learning. You know, most pianos have a very similar setup. It's a little bench. The keys are laid out. Of course, now there's all kinds of electronic models, but, you know, your basic Steinway piano. I mentioned state-dependent learning. When I was in grad school, the behavior mod professor said, if you really want to excel at something, you do it the same place, the same time, every time. If you want to do well in a test, you take your notes in the same seat in the classroom, and then you go and you review those notes in the same seat before you take the test, right? So the same thing applies with, you know, playing an instrument or all the little rituals that people go through with sports. You know, my special tennis socks, or I've got to have this racket. I can't have that racket. I've got to have this racket. It's all part of it. You're convincing yourself that you have to have that particular setup in order for it to work. The same thing is involved with formal sitting practice, state-dependent learning. You know, I have this place in my bedroom where this device is set up, and I sit there every morning. When I was doing psychotherapy, I would meditate in my office chair when I had clients no-show, right? So that when I did have someone sitting in front of me, my body was in the same place, in the same process, when someone was telling me what's troubling them. So that enabled me to be more resilient in that kind of situation. Does that mm-hmm. clarify it? Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say the word I use is habit. I mean, mm-hmm. for me, I just sort of say, you know, and you've explained it in much more detail, that restlessness and worry is what is my main hindrance. Mm-hmm. And if I just when I'm walking, take a few deep breaths, I become more tranquil. And that changes the habit of restlessness. It happens less frequently.
Yes.
I've got a good habit instead of a bad habit.
Yes. So that brings to mind something that I would suggest to someone who was, you know, worrying a lot, which is one of the characteristics of an anxiety disorder. So I would encourage them to recognize the experience as just an event. It's not self-defining. And then decide that you're going to channel the energy of your attention somewhere else. Walk in nature. Or do something intentional, like knitting. You know, don't do knitting on automatic. Do it deliberately, you know, so that the energy is not flowing into the oh my God story. It's going someplace else. Because the oh my God story takes up too much bandwidth. So you need to modify that. But it takes some persistent, ongoing effort to do it. Other questions or comments? Yes,
Mitch. Your point, though, is that effortless effort can be in a negative situation.
Absolutely.
Positive. That's just really wild when you think about it.
That's right. That's right. That's the default mode of humanity. Yes, ma'am. You had something, Charlotte?
Yes.
When you talked about restlessness and worry, you talked about foreseeing a negative outcome, and that you would fear it. To me, that's not a given.
Well, it's something that's called a confirmation bias. That people, out of habit, will start to develop a self-identity as a worrier. So they will find something to worry about. Because if I'm not worrying, I'm not me. Now, the person doesn't consciously, deliberately think this through. But that's what happens. And confirmation bias is very well researched. It's probably an article in Wikipedia about confirmation bias, too. That if you already have a preconceived expectation or belief, any new data that does not conform to that expectation or belief will be ignored or disputed.
But does foreseeing something that anyone would consider negative necessarily mean that you fear it? Can't you just see it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It doesn't mean, and you might even have some fear. I'll bring the story out again that Jack Kornfield and Ajahn Chah were traveling in northern Thailand on a narrow hilltop road in the backseat of a taxi driven by a crazy man who would pass on blind curbs and drive recklessly. And Jack is, you know, he's wearing his monk's robes and all that stuff, and he's terrified. And he thinks, oh, I'm not a very good Buddhist because I'm terrified. And he turned and he looked at Ajahn Chah, who has dark skin, and the guy was pale, right? And he's gripping the back of the front seat like this. And they got there, and Ajahn Chah was an acknowledged master, okay, an acknowledged, well-respected master meditator. They got there, and Ajahn Chah got out of the car, and he looked at Jack, and he said, that was interesting, wasn't it? So, you know, your body is hardwired to fear. It's a normal, natural thing. It's not like we're getting rid of anxiety. What we're trying to do is avoid perpetuating it. There might be a startle moment of anxiety, but then there's no story that builds on it and reinforces it. Because there are two things going on. I mentioned affect. Affect is the driver. And then there's cognition. And cognition is going on elsewhere in the brain. It's you know, searching through all the memory files of previous experiences if there are any similarity to affect or circumstance. And those two intermingle and they become mutually reinforcing. So there's this level of anxiety, adrenaline in the system. The adrenaline is alarming. It activates the cognitive system that creates an oh my God story. The oh my God story seems to validate the feeling, so it very quickly escalates. And this is characteristic of the sympathetic system. The sympathetic system is a quick react system. The parasympathetic is a slow system. Takes time for the parasympathetic to kick in. So that's why we can jump to a conclusion very quickly. And we're hardwired for that. That's how our ancestors survived out in the wild. Right? You know, fear is you know, a more basic instinct than desire. That's what you're contending with. It's trying to interrupt that. That's right. Well, no, not to fear, but to understand the arousal, the physical arousal of fear as a phenomenon and disregard the storyline.
Like I know that I will die and I don't fear that.
Yeah, me too.
So you can learn not to fear something that other people consider fearful.
Yes. And here's the deal about samadhi posse. You cultivate in the balance of the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, and in the brain, you cultivate this quality of peacefulness and buoyancy. And then something happens. Because you've created this buffer, your reaction time to the anxiety-provoking stimulus is slowed down. It doesn't jump up and take over as quickly. Now, the classic story that I've used many times, because Buddhists have used it for millennia, you're walking down a pathway late at night, and there's some kind of a coil laying in the pathway. It's not very well lighted. Now, we are hardwired to be alert to snakes. So there's going to be an instinctive reaction to that, a little surge of adrenaline. When the mind is not well prepared, it will jump to the conclusion that's a snake and react accordingly. However, because of the benefit of samadhi paucity, there's this interval of, it doesn't take very long, a second or less, of non-reactivity, and more information comes into the system. It says, no, it's not a snake, it's a piece of rope. And the system calms down. So what we're trying to do, remember I mentioned nama rupa? Nama is samadhi paucity. Rupa is this serpentine form that's stimulating the optical process. But the more you have samadhi paucity in the nama formula, the less impulsively reactive the mind is. And that's an important thing to recognize. I mentioned earlier that I would fly into a fury at myself for having made a really insignificant error. And I could psychoanalyze that out the wazoo, but I would still get upset. But over years of practice, now I notice that I'm in a situation that previously would prompt this kind of harshness, but I'm just not inclined to go there. So that's how that works. And the same thing is about fear of dying. You know, I might be scared. Depends on the circumstances. But right now, no, I'm not scared. I'm not preoccupied with it. I don't fantasize about it.
You don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Nope. I've lived a good life. Grateful for it.
To circle back to the Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield story, so is the moral of that really that, yes, you are scared during it, but it's the quick recovery and then leaving it there,
mm-hmm.
moving
yeah.
forward then?
Yeah. Affect response is hardwired into the nervous system. So there's going to be a surge. But then accompanying it is a meaning-making storyline. When the meaning-making storyline takes over, it reinforces the alarm. So as this initial squirt of adrenaline, it's normal and natural. Any organism is going to have that. But the story says, okay, more adrenaline. This is really bad. It's going to get worse. More adrenaline, more adrenaline. So there's more and more adrenaline, which calls up more and more storyline. So they kind of revolve around each other, right? So the idea is to be able to accept the urgent physical, emotional event as real and not be quite so convinced about the storyline. Therefore, the adrenaline kind of burns out of the system. It metabolizes out. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
That's how it works.
Plus they didn't die.